Hello, everyone. Today on Policy Talk, we have a very interesting guest, somebody I've known for quite some time, a CEO, a social entrepreneur, catalyst for ideas in many ways, also a UNICEF representative, and runs an organization called GAME, which is very actively engaged in ease of doing business and again promoting youth entrepreneurship. Ravi Venkatesan, welcome to Policy Talks.
Hi, Yatish. It's fabulous to be in conversation with you. Thank you so much for the invitation.
So today, Ravi, you've written this wonderful book. I, being a junkie of self-help books, couldn't So I read it, and I also wanted my son to read it, who's now in, finished his college. And I thought, it's rightfully aimed at that segment too. But tell us, what kind of book it is and what is the primary messages you wanted to convey through this book? Yes.
So here's the book that Yatish, you're talking about. It's called What the Heck Do I Do With My Life? And the subtitle, which is smaller, says How to Flourish in Turbulent Times, which is the kind of period we're living through. So you said, what kind of a book is it? I'd like to think of it as a book about personal leadership. If you were walking into a physical bookstore, well, right now you'll find it, it's doing very well, so you'll find it right near the door. But after a year or so, you may find it in the self-help section. But you'll also find a copy in the leadership section, I hope. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the point, the sort of central message here is we're living in a period of extraordinary change. The world will change more in the 21st century than all of human history. And the reason there's a dinosaur on the cover is because when there's a period of such sudden and extreme change, many, many species fail to adapt. And what happens is those who do manage to flourish and those who don't adapt perish, like the poor old dinosaur. And so this period of extreme...
I think the dinosaur didn't have a chance, there was no way it could have survived that environment.
Way too fast. But the good news from that extinction was that mammals became dominant, and otherwise we wouldn't be there. I'm not sure whether the planet considers it good news. But the point is, this period is extremely challenging for a lot of people. It also throws up incredible opportunities, as we are seeing. So those who are able to cash in on those opportunities will do very well. And so I try to point out, what is the mindset that you need? What are some of the skills and the strategies you need in order to flourish in these times?
And I want to talk to you about those skills. You talk about certain very important meta skills. And you talk about these skills as being more important than a college degree or even a higher education degree. And interestingly, most of these skills that you point out are, you say in your book, makes us more human, like better social and leadership skill, creativity and complex problem solving skills. Most of these skills cannot be just taught from a book or very difficult to kind of teach creativity, for instance, in a course, put those people who are taking the course into actually a project itself, so constructive conversations or project management is the way to learn these skills. What is your understanding? Where should people go to learn these meta skills?
Yeah, so first of all, as you say, the education system in most parts of the world, or almost all parts of the world, is catering to a world that no longer exists. World that was stable, where there were more of the reasonably abundant jobs for those who were educated, a world in which information was scarce. And all that has changed. And so I say, look, there are three or four meta skills or super skills that will really, really matter. And those are, one is learning agility, which is the ability to, in a situation that you've never encountered before, figure things out. The second one is an entrepreneurial mindset. Not everybody is going to be an entrepreneur, but everybody needs the capacity to see opportunity, seize it, to be tenacious, creative, problem solvers. And then, as you said, the third meta skill is, you know, the life skills. Funnily enough, even as computers are becoming more and more capable and robots are becoming more and more capable, there's a huge premium on the ability to work with each other to solve problems. Almost every problem, except the simplest ones, require collaboration within an organization, across organizations, or even across sectors. So things like creativity, problem solving, collaboration, communication, all these social skills become hugely important. Now, interestingly, as you say, none of these three skills can be learned in a classroom and certainly can't be learned online. And the only way to learn it is through real world experiences, particularly what I call crucible experiences, which is take on challenges which are outside your comfort zone. And in the process of, you know, figuring it out, you develop all these skills. So I look back at my life and what were the crucible experiences. For instance, going to IIT was a crucible experience because I'd always lived at home, living in a hostel, work, and competing with some really smart people was quite tough. Okay, going to the US and, you know, with almost no money, graduate education, finding a job, scrappily climbing my way up was a crucible experience, etc. So these kinds of very difficult challenges is how you develop it. But the point is, everybody can learn these skills. Right now, we run that huge program in Delhi government schools called the Entrepreneurship Mindset Curriculum. And we've seen millions, 2 million kids having gone through the program and, you know, learned it experientially. So it's very doable. That's the good news.
So the crucible is what students should search out for if they don't find it.
Not just students. This is lifelong, Yatish.
Yes.
What you're doing right now, to me, sounds like a crucible experience with your institute, right? And yes. So I think that's the point. It's not something you do only as a student. You do this lifelong. Every few years, if you look at my own life, every 7 years on average, I've taken on a completely new challenge. And that's how we reinvent ourselves.
The seven-year-old lecture. So life to skills too. Good. So, moving on from skills and skill, meta skills, there's one interesting part which, you know, got my attention in your book is the crucial issue of longer lifespan. And you say something very interesting, and I wanted to quote that. You say that to retire at 60 and spend the next 30 years vacationing will be boring and unhealthy. Oh, this is such a true statement in so many ways. I see my parents' generation, which retired in their 50s or 60s, and next 20, 25, 30 years have been a tough one for them because they've found it increasingly difficult to get engaged or get immersed into their second profession. And I see it very often happening with even people in not my batch, but you know, a couple of batches senior to me, that they are work free, but they're not income free. They still have sources of income. Sure. So there's no clear reason for them to
work.
But even if they do want to work, it's not very easy for them to find work.
True.
And that is one class. And you have certain advice for them, which I would like you to recount again. And there's a second class, which is of people who are, you know, whose desires for needs, basic needs are being met through income. And this is a younger generation. And they, again, don't have any desire and ambition, you know, especially in the metros, you know, you see multiple families. What is your advice for both these segments?
Yeah, look, it turns out that work is profoundly important for our well-being, okay? And I think to just focus on the income part of work trivializes it. Good work, and I'm sure you will appreciate this from your own personal experience, provides so many other things. For instance, identity. So if I say, oh, who are you? Or somebody asks me, who are you? I'll often or very quickly sort of talk about what I do. I'm a journalist. I'm a writer, I'm an entrepreneur, I'm a so-and-so. So identity is something that comes. You get from through work, you find your community. Through work, you learn new things. You get the experience and satisfaction of accomplishing things, which is psychologically hugely important. So it's not just income. So what happens when you retire, if you even if you financially are secure, is what how are you going to get all those other things? Okay, how are you going to find your community? How are you going to find meaning, purpose, etc.? So that's why I say, look, retirement is a seriously bad idea. And what you need to do is find a way to stay engaged and productive. But the problem is, as you know, companies don't like to hire even somebody who's 50-year-old, yes, let alone 60, 70, 75. So that's one issue. And the second one is that knowledge is changing very, very quickly. And so you can be obsolete every, you know, in 5 years. So you have to stay abreast from a skills and knowledge perspective. And so this is why, particularly as we are living longer and longer lives, it is important to figure out, you know, this intersection between what you find interesting, what you're good at, and, you know, what you enjoy. And that's the way you stay, you know.
You have managed to do that quite successively, you know, not only change industries, but also manage to be relevant in doing new things. UNICEF, the new chairmanship that you are taking on in the energy field.
Yeah.
What do you think was the key there? Was it the network or was it the continuous effort or knowledge?
Beautiful question. So because while whatever the number of transitions I have made sounds unusual today, I think it's going to be the norm a decade from today.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that.
And the key is what I call in chapter one, the intangible assets. We always think about tangible assets like your savings, your house and all that. But the intangible assets, which is your networks, your reputation, your professional reputation, your expertise, your health, your family and close relationships, these are crucial. And these are crucial, Yatish, because A, as we have shocks like the pandemic,
they are what
cushion you. And number two, these are what make you portable. So I can go from making diesel engines to software to Bank of Baroda to UNICEF to being a social entrepreneur with GAME to tomorrow the energy field reasonably seamlessly, because I have cultivated these assets very consciously. So this is one of the things that I highly, highly recommend to people. Think about your intangible assets at least as much as you cultivate your tangible assets.
Yeah, and you all, I mean, you often mention this part again and again in your book about basically the half-life of skills and how that is shrinking, you know? 5 years, 7 years, 3 years. And now I've also written a lot about the fact that that these skills are becoming, you know, how quickly are we becoming obsolete in this world? And to prevent that, what do we need to do? Because one of the things is that you keep learning new skills, but the way you learn skills is also changing. I mean, for instance, the ability for memorizing or remembering things and is no longer so important because everything is available at the tap of a button, not, you know, even not at a tap, but you can say it in your Google or a CD, what are you looking for? So, you know, now memory is in some sense the primary skill which we look for in, say, judging ability. You know, we judge ability of people based on how they did in exams, tests, including, you know, the bureaucracy is judged based on a test or exam that they passed and given responsibilities, so on and so forth. Of course, this whole concept is being questioned in various ways that is it sufficient to know and not know how to do it? Is project management as a skill far more important than knowing about project management, you know? Is engineering skill engineering knowledge important or actually having constructed engineering projects important? You know, there is a differentiation being drawn, especially as execution becomes more and more important with the government. How do you see this affecting, you know, this current affecting not only the way that students look at their skills and also how government looks at these skills within their own bureaucracy?
So you're absolutely right. The educational system in India and in most countries is obsolete, as we discussed before. 50 years ago, information was scarce. So what was important is how well you memorize information, facts, etc., because that was an advantage. And so you tested people on how much they had memorized, how well they had memorized. Today, as you say, a child with a cell phone has all the world's information at his or her fingertips. So what matters is not what you know, but whether you know how to find information. Okay, so that becomes more important. And the kind of skill that is important now is being able to connect the dots across fields in order to synthesize a picture. So this is why these new age skills...
Which is creativity, in other words, you know?
Which is creativity.
From one realm and apply it to another.
Yeah, lateral thinking, all these kinds of other skills are more important. But neither does the education system or corporate learning know how to deliver this, nor are we assessing them. But if you see new age companies like Google, they are now saying, look, we no longer need an undergraduate degree or certificate. What matters is that you pass our aptitude test, and they are testing for these things. Okay, so more and more people are realizing the importance of these skills over the degree. And you're seeing this also in the unemployment figures, Yatish, because young people with a higher education degree are more unemployed than people with a basic degree. Okay, and so we have this.
Interestingly, the army has always recruited on the basis of skills. You know, so the army recruitment thing has three components. You know, it has a physical component. It of course has a test to kind of reduce the number of applicants and get a basic IQ level. But the second tests are very important. There's a psychological test, and there is a physical problem solving test, which puts people, groups of people in a problem, a physical problem, to traverse the area with obstacles. And then based on how they have tackled it, they come to a judge. Right. Now, this is not used in IIMs, it's not used in corporates, and it is certainly not used in government.
That's beautiful.
In a sense, it is, this should come back. What you're telling me about Google, I've seen Google, even now some of the consulting firms are saying that degree is not important. But then what is important? I don't think so. They have defined it very well.
But Google in particular has done a good job defining what is important. And I describe the results of that briefly in my book. But you're talking about the army, but even, when I was with Cummins and we were setting up our new factory in Jamshedpur in 1996, and I was the CEO there, the way we recruited our workforce is by actually getting them to do simple tasks and seeing whether they would follow instructions, how well they worked with each other in teams and so forth. And that's the basis on which we recruited them. And we learned this actually even before from BMW. So there are a few companies that have over time have figured this out. I think Taj Hotels, Indian Hotels also, has been clever about this stuff for quite some time. But such firms are the exception. I think more and more are figuring it out.
So another issue that I wanted you to touch upon a little bit, most of the advice that you've given in the book, you used your own learnings in your own career. For instance, you talk about money and greed, how your views on it has changed and where was your ambition in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and subsequently how it has changed. You know, a generation that has come out from shortage typically has a different view of things. Now we see the youth of today, you know, Tyler calls it a complacent class. I call it the age of excess. It's very different. Do you see an overall change in the both the ambition and the desire to earn money in the new generation too?
I think that's a very good but a complex question, because when you talk about the new generation, it's a very large number of people.
Yes, yes.
And therefore, they too, there's a distribution of all over the spectrum, right? So there are still people who are striving and want to make it big. There are those who don't believe that is important, but saving a crumbling planet or making society around them better is more, you know, inspiring thing. A lot of young people today, they are driven much more than my generation or your generation, Yatish, by the calling to make the world better. And they look for their thing. And then you have others who are fairly content, and there's some, as long as some basic needs are met, they're okay. A heck of a lot of people are still living on the edge, okay, and barely making ends meet. So my point in this chapter, which you talk about, is, look, the question, how much is enough? Yes. There are a lot of people who don't have enough. It's very clear that they need to figure out first how to get to that point. But there are a lot of people, and I was one of them for some time, who are insecure about money. And so they keep doing whatever they're doing, even though they no longer find it meaningful, no longer get joy, but either out of insecurity or greed, they stay on the treadmill instead of pursuing, you know, something that, let's say, something more purposeful. And that's why I say, look, the money is like salt, you know, in the sense that too little salt or too much salt, you have a problem. You need to have just enough. And just enough money gives you freedom. So how do you find out the answer to how much is enough? So I'm actually catering to a very modest number of people who are struggling with the issue of how much is enough so that I can get on and do what I really want to do. So, yeah, but I do think the world is very, very diverse. I work a lot in UNICEF with younger people, typically 15 to 24. And I'm amazed at their determination to build a good life for themselves. I wouldn't characterize most of them as, you know, content, easily content, and parents have made a little money, I have a roof over my head, so let me go enjoy. That, I think, may describe some minority. And a lot of them are go-getters. And I think even in my entrepreneurship work, what we're trying to do is get more and more of them to say, heck with a job, yaar. Let's go build something. And when you see a show like Shark Tank, you know, you begin to see the raw energy in a lot of our young people. So I'm actually very optimistic. If you ask me, in a crazy world, what are one or two reasons to feel optimistic? I would actually say young people everywhere.
Last question, Ravi, and more about the book and the writing process, because a lot of our listeners would be journalists or possibly aspiring writers. What is your writing schedule like? How do you plan it? How did you plan this book?
Yeah, I'm an occasional writer. This is my second book. And I, you know, when I care about a topic, I write about it in the form of a 800 to 2000 word piece. And then I shop it around and so forth. So I wouldn't say I'm a serious, disciplined writer like, say, you. But my writing approach has been to take a topic, think about it. I then research it. And by reading books, getting on the net, etc., I take lots of notes for a tech executive. So these are all various notes. Okay, so I still use, you know, interestingly, people like Bill Gates, they still don't use technology. They still use these things. And I'm sort of that school. I put it on lots of pieces of paper. And then what I do is try to go away. I go away somewhere and try and get into a flow. And when I get into that flow after 2 or 3 days of decompressing, I'm able to be enormously productive. So in my last book, for instance, luckily I got a Rockefeller scholarship to go writing and stay in Italy in their Bellagio Center. And I wrote one perfect chapter every day. I would get up in the morning, start writing at 8 a.m. And by 4 p.m., I would have a near perfect chapter. It was like the universe was dictating and I was simply typing, okay? Wow. And so I came away with a nearly perfect book. This book also, I went away because of COVID. I couldn't go far away, but I ended up renting a place on the edge of outskirts of Bangalore, which is very quiet, very rural, but which has a lovely restaurant nearby. And I did a lot of my writing starting by 8 a.m. every morning and through the day. So yeah, I try and get into a zone where I'm productive.
Interesting. And what advice do you have for promoting a book and choosing a publisher?
Yeah, that's a really practical and good question. My first publisher was Harvard Business Review. And that's because it was a serious business book. And so I wanted a publisher who focused on business books and catered to that space. This time I wanted reach. I wanted to reach as many people as possible. So after some discussions, I picked Rupa because they have a very wide distribution. What I've realized, Yatish, is that the economics of publishing have really changed over the decade.
Yes.
And you know, they don't make a lot of money on these books, except the occasional hit like Amish Tripathi or something like that. And so most of them actually don't do a lot. And so I would tell every author, that to young first-time authors, writing a good book is 10% of the job. Going out and talking about it is 90% of the job, which is what we're doing today. The other thing is the reading habit has really declined.
Yes.
Very, very few people read books or buy books and go through them. So the book is mostly for organizing your own thoughts and having a calling card like this. The rest of it, you have to get out in the form of podcasts, conversations, talks, videos, etc. Because the world is consuming information today in a very, very different way. And yes. So the book is only the starting point.
Yes, yes, very true, very true. Actually, you know, to paraphrase what you're saying, I see the book as the starting point, not just for a podcast or video, but also for a course, you know. So you should actually turn this book into a course, which anybody and everybody can come in, enter, learn, and then, you know, get out. You know, even they don't have to spend the whole 18 hours or 15 hours, whatever the duration of the course, but even if they do it modularly, it's like would have enormous impact, you know, because I feel this book particularly compared to the last book is rightfully geared for a course, you know.
Absolutely right. And your instinct is totally correct. I even turned the last book into a course, which we taught for a number of years at IIM Bangalore. And this one we are turning into both short program as well as a longer program. We're creating a 5-day masterclass right now.
Wonderful, that's the way.
Yeah, so all that will be coming out fairly soon, but it's a great suggestion and a good idea. Thank you.
Wonderful. Wonderful to talk to you, Ravi, and looking forward to that masterclass. I'm sure we'll have another discussion when the masterclass is out, because I would love to kind of go through the masterclass myself.
Well, we'll treat that as a willing volunteer then.
Yes, okay. Wonderful. Thank you very much, Ravi. Good.
Thank you, Yatish, for having me here.